This is Andreas from AO Performance, and today we're going to talk about a thing that most people in life will feel at some point. I think science says it's like 90% of all people will have, at some point in their life, will feel back pain. And I know there's a lot of athletes that has back pain, and yours truly, myself, had to quit hockey because of back problems. So my dream went to not being a dream anymore because I couldn't play. I have three disc herniations. I woke up one morning and I couldn't feel my right leg. It was completely numbed. I had to go to the emergency room. It was bad. And the help I got from that was not the best. And since that day, I've been passionate to help others don't have to quit their dream or their passion or their sport like I had to do, because that was tough. And so what is better to have, what I think, what many people think, the number one guy in the world when it comes to back pain, Dr. Stuart McKill. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Andreas, or good afternoon in Sweden. But yeah. Nice. We know one another, but nice to see you again today.
Yeah, great to see you too. And it's a complete honor to have you on, because I've respected your work for many, 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 many years. And your book was one of the first books I ever read. And I have all your books, and I read them still a lot. And I still learn from them. That's how good they are. Like 20 years later, they're still good.
Well, I don't think our athletes have changed too much over the last 20 years.
That is true. But a little bit if you take us back a little bit, first, I know what my passion came from. That was, I had to quit hockey because of back pain, and I promised to give back. I wanted to come back to, I wanted to be in the NHL because that was my dream, and I got the second best. I've been working with NHL players since 2006, pretty much. Started with Henrik Zetterberg. He had back problems, and I helped him, and he got well, and he got pain-free in a couple of weeks. And then the word spread, and since that day, it was 06, I think, I've been working with over 60 different NHL players, and it's been incredible. So I ended up in the NHL, but not on the ice, so it's been pretty cool. So that's where my passion started. So tell me a little bit about your journey, Stu, about where did it start, and why the passion of back pain?
Just as a little aside, I was obviously growing up in Canada as a young kid playing hockey with dreams of making the NHL one day as well. And then that didn't pan out, but I played old timers hockey, and I swore every year, by the time I'm 40, I'm going to make the NHL.
Love it.
Anyway, well, through a lot of circumstances, I was never university material as a young man, that's for sure. But through a series of very, very strange events, I ended up going to university, doing a master's degree, and then a PhD in spine biomechanics. And then I became a professor, and I just started with one question, and it was, how does the spine work? I would look at the available descriptions of how the spine worked, and most of them used what we call external mechanics. So if I held my arm out and I put a kilo or half a kilo of butter in my hand, that would create a load on my elbow, and people would measure whatever that load is. That's right. Called external mechanics. I couldn't live with that because as a biomechanist, you know that there's internal tissues that support the load. So I'm holding half a kilo of butter. Now the bicep, the brachioradialis, et cetera, have to contract to hold the 5 kilos, but their mechanical advantage is very close to the center of the joint. They need 15 times the force of the 15 times the lever arm, or the right distance of the butter from my elbow. They only have 1/15th of the mechanical advantage. So to hold half a kilo of butter, I need 15 times that, or 7.5 kilo just to hold that. Well, most athletes could hold 30 kilo. Now getting into hundreds of kilos in those muscles squeezing the joint. Now let's go to the spine. I could bend over or back squat a bar, whether it's good technique or poor. If I bend forward, the bar has a very large mechanical leverage on my low back, but my low back muscles are much, much smaller. So there's a huge load amplification down through the spine. And when we get into those situations, all of a sudden, I realized this is a wonderful machine that follows biology and science on how to create magnificent athletic performance, power production through the hips, transmitting through the core, as long as you keep measuring internal mechanics that is robust enough to recognize all the muscles and how they share loads without creating a stress concentration. The passive tissues, the discs themselves, you know, I can't take my shirt and create stress strain reversals back and forth like this forever. Eventually, the fibers will delaminate. And it's exactly the same thing that happens with biological tissues, the collagen in the discs and whatnot. Sometimes they will adapt or they create cumulative trauma, whatever side of the biological tipping point you're on. Anyway, it's a long way round of answering the question of where did the passion come from? People would then ask me, I'd go to a medical meeting perhaps, and the orthopedics in there would say, oh, well, would you see a patient with me? And then I find out one of the orthopedics is a professional team physician in football or soccer or hockey or whatever. Oh, would you come and talk to our medical staff here on the hockey team? And then all of a sudden, I realized there was quite a disconnect in those days. Now, that was 40 years ago. So I would say a lot of progress has been made. But the passion came from just keep working on trying to understand the science of why one player responds, the next one doesn't. It just became a never-ending quest. And I guess that's where the passion came from. And nothing more than that. Simple interest. I was so lucky.
Yeah, and curious, I guess. And being obviously a very smart person, you wanted to figure it out. And I totally respect that. And
well, here's an analogy for you. If you were a car mechanic and you got to today work on a Ferrari, tomorrow you get to work on a Bugatti. The next day you get to work on a BMW F1 tuned race car. Wouldn't that be fabulous as a car mechanic if you could do that?
Yeah.
So on one day, I work with an NHL superstar. The next day is a combat athlete from the UFC. The next day is a long distance runner. Totally different athleticisms to measure and explore. How's that for a life? Isn't that exciting?
And it's absolutely incredible. I know because I've done the same thing. And then like maybe for 10 plus years ago, I decided to go hockey and alpine skiing only because those two are my passions. And I was doing really well. I was the trainer of the year here in Sweden in 2013. And I wanted to be in the NHL at the arenas, and I wanted to be in the best slopes in the world to with the alpine skiers. So I work with both the German alpine national team and the United States U.S. ski team, and the German and the U.S. and the Sweden team. So it's been pretty cool. It's been a journey, and but those are two of my passions, and I focus on those. But in the beginning, my first 10 years, I had any athlete in every walks of life, like any person, just to get better, you know. So I understand completely where you're coming from, where you're talking about. So, but can we go back to my, because I'm when I have you here, I'll be stupid if I don't ask you about my, because I had to quit my dream. And obviously very emotional, but because I was back squatting 220 kilos, I have a goaltender that I played with at the time. He still today says I did six reps on 220. I don't remember that, so I can't verify that. I remember I did one at least, but still, I was very strong. I remember too that I always was in pain. And my dad always asked me because he saw I was doing stuff with my gloves and over my back during the games. And I'm like, he's like, how much pain do you have? I'm like, a lot. And finally, I broke, obviously, completely. And I know that I could barely walk. My hips were so stiff that I had trouble like walking and running. And I thought it was just for the pain, but today I know better. And to see myself back then, what I did, and being a young super talent too, I was not going to say no that I had pain. You know, hockey players, we don't say that we have pain. We just go. And I did. I did 135 in 8 kilos in bench press too. So I was pretty strong, you know. And I think around 270, 260, 270 in deadlift. So I was a strong guy at the gym. So two things. One, obviously, I broke. I got three disc herniations. So woke up one morning and my right leg was numb. And second, I never felt strong on the ice. I was super strong at the gym, never felt strong in movements. So if we start with the first one, what do you think happened to me?
Well, I could probably predict with some precision. I can show you in a little model. I can show you in a slideshow that I have on my computer here as sure. Well, if you would like.
I'd love that.
But the first thing first, in Canada, when we get young hockey players from the prairies, from the farm country of Canada in the middle, and you know who I'm talking about.
Yep.
Everyone knows they're what we call farm boy strong. Now, yeah. You get a player on the ice and you try and take the puck away from a farm boy strong player, you will not push him off the puck. Now, nope. They don't perform very well in the weight room, but they have tremendous balance. And that's really what I can say, a balance and a sense of driving the thrust lines through their body that you cannot push them off the puck. Whereas it's a bit of a folklore, but anyway, that's the impression that exists, and it exists because it's quite often true.
Yeah.
There is a segment of your spine. Now, if you had a disc bulge, I'm just going to show you inside the disc is a gel. Think of it as incompressible hydraulic fluid. And then around the gel are collagen strands. It's actually a fabric, layer upon layer, like an onion skin. Now, remember when I said with stress strain reversals, the fibers of my shirt eventually will delaminate. If you keep moving the spine under load, so that's the caveat. You can move your spine around without load, and the delamination stresses will not accumulate. But when you add load and bad posture, here's what happens. Can you see right there a little red mark at the back? Watch what happens. Yeah. I'm going to squeeze the spine and bend it forward at the same time. Let me just get the nerve out of the way. And you're going to see right there.
Yep.
You see the disc bulge? Okay.
Yep.
Now I'm going to stack the spine tall. I'm going to squeeze even harder, but I won't let it bend forward. So that when I bent forward, the hydraulic stresses were pushed posteriorly. Yep. Watch. Nothing comes out the disc, and you can really see it squeezed down. So it's 100% once the delamination has occurred, once that fissure has occurred through the fabric annulus, now that disc bulge can press on a nerve root. So a hockey player quite often skates with a flexed spine, etc. But you and I both have outstanding players active in the NHL who've learned to manage that through their exercise programming and also the demeanor throughout the day. They don't sit on a floppy soft couch, or when they're on the team bus, they wear a lumbar support when they're sitting there. All of these things are building capacity to play on the ice because it's finite now. They don't have 16-year-old unlimited abilities anymore, and the clever ones are taught how to manage it. And that, in a summary, is what we do. But the way a disc bulge occurred in your specific case, and you were lifting heavy, do you want me to show you a little bit of a series of slides to explain that?
Absolutely. That'd be great.
It's really quite graphic.
Yeah.
So I just have to go back now. Let me expand this. I'm just going to share my screen, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
So host disabled participant, I believe you have to make me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like that, so, right?
Let me try this. I'm going to share the screen. I'm going to share the sound. I don't know if there is any. And let me see. Oh, heck, where? Let me see if I can find it here. And I'll just put up, there we go. And let me just see the disc adaptation one. Okay. Let's start the story. Can you see that?
I see your email. Your Outlook.
Can you see that PowerPoint slide now?
Nope.
End show. Let me go. Let me stop the share. Sorry about that. And let me see if I can get it now. There it is. Okay. And I'm going to share that. Now, can you see that slide?
Yep, that's perfect. Great.
All right. So here is, we're going to go back in time now to young Andreas, the beast wanting to play in the NHL. There you are there. What that would be considered very poor form, an unstiffened core, very poor line of drive, etc. This happens to be the man in the U.S. who holds the over 75-year-old deadlift record. But nonetheless, I'm going to take a animal spine just because I couldn't find a human volunteer here. Yeah. And you can see with very high resolution CT scanning, the bone structure and the end plates, and there's the hydraulic disc. Now we're going to squeeze that twice body weight, and then we're going to put it back in the scanner, and you see the broken bits of bone underneath the end plate, which is the top and bottom of the vertebra.
Yep.
So the disc has flattened and the bone has broken a little bit. Now, here is the major question. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? It was a bad thing for young Andreas because you would create those microfractures and then you'd go back to the gym in a couple of days and you would add more cumulative trauma to those microfractures, and they got worse and worse and worse and worse. But a highly trained power lifter, which is an entirely different athlete, also gets microfractures like this, but they only train once a week. And you would say they are very undertrained. But what they're doing is those microfractures are attracting bone building minerals like calcium and magnesium, and they electrically, piezoelectrically, scaffold them in. So in other words, they form a bone callus. They strengthen their bone through the training program of only lifting once a week those heavy. But you didn't know that because you were a keen one. So this is the beginning of a disc bulge, but I'm showing it starting as a deadlift or a heavy squat or something that was inappropriate for where you were. Yeah. So once the disc height is lost, many things start to change. Nerves start to grow into the disc. So it's so unfair, you actually start to feel more back pain. You put more load on the facet joints. So now when you're skating side to side, the facet joints start to become a little bit worn and angry. The nerve space is now shrunk down just a little bit because of the height loss. So now that nerve root, you said you're getting a numb foot. Okay, yep. That's a little bit of foraminal stenosis, as it's called. So there's lots of bad things that happen. Now let me transform the cascade that you must have undergone into a disc bulge.
Yeah.
Here is a former NHL hockey player. Do you remember the hockey strike? I forget how many years ago, but maybe 12 or 15 years ago, when the hockey players went on strike.
Yep.
Ones went to Europe to play. The older ones stayed here and they healed. You know, my shoulder colleagues would look after their shoulders. I'd end up looking after their spines. But the beautiful thing with that natural experiment was the 10-year veteran would come here to BackFit Pro and they'd bring their MRIs every single year. I knew how many goals they scored. I knew how many games they missed due to back injury every year. And I also knew their training programs. So here we go. Here is a veteran, and you can see in the left panel there, do you see my little arrow moving around, Andreas?
Absolutely. Yep.
Do you see the end plate fracture? There's white stuff under the end plate and a little white fracture right there. So
right.
Now they had too heavy a deadlift. But they then worked with a trainer who said, let's do ass to grass, deep squats and whatnot. Well, then you get a disc bulge. Now in surgery, this is the surgery report. They do an assay, or they examine the disc material that's been extruded and harvested by the surgeon. There were fragments of cartilaginous end plate, fibrous tissue, and cancellous bone. In other words, it started with an end plate fracture, and then the delaminated collagen through the very deep and appropriate squats with bad form over and over delaminated the collagen. The broken cartilage was carried through into the extruded material. Well,
right.
Rare? I don't think so. When you look at the data on the harvested material from disc herniation, 65% of them start with end plate fracture because they have broken bits of cartilage bone that was in the disc and carried through.
Right.
So you add loaded flexion over and over again, which is more deep squats and whatnot. Now, I don't know when the last time I saw a hockey player do a deep squat, but I don't think you know of too many either. But anyway,
no.
really the best training. So I can go on and on how the disc bulges then form, what you need to do to adapt the disc, which you and I both do, to vacuum in the nucleus through good posture, staying upright, keeping a lordotic as much as possible. You still have to play the game. We get that.
Yeah.
But we build play capacity by moving well throughout the rest of the day. And, you know, I'm one of the few guys who've proven that you can suck in the disc bulge by doing what we call spine hygiene and training well. And then I can go really into the weeds on this, if you like, on other mechanisms of how to shrink disc bulges and how there's two different types of disc bulges, et cetera. But it all comes down to training appropriately, moving well, programming the right amount of volume. And if you violate any of those, you and I will fail in our jobs to restore that career. So that's probably a start, but I hope that gives a little bit of a link between heavy, inappropriate, and poor programmed squats and deadlifts, not given the proper time to. And then we could go into the question, is that the athleticism that will put more pucks in the net or not? That's a whole different conversation. But anyway, is that helpful for your...
Absolutely. I think it's brilliant, and it makes a lot of sense. And I think it's makes my heart warm just to hear you speak about this, because, I understand why it happened. And I know the guys who trained us back then did what they the best that they could that they learned, and they had a heart at the right place. But you know, it's tough, and to train maybe especially hockey play. Hockey is such a complex sport, and with weird movements, and it's really really tough. And you have to know your shit if you're going to train high level hockey players to make them better and make them pain free. Because so I just when you were talking about that, something hit me. Just why do you think that is? That hockey players get very lordotic, meaning like they walk like a duck, if I'm using a layman's term. Like I mean, it was more before when it was a lot more weightlifting in hockey. I mean, now it's reduced a lot, but it's still too much, I think. But a lot of hockey players looked like a duck when they were walking because of the big lordotic curve. Why do you think that happened? Is it because of so much skating? Is it weird technique in skating? Is it the stiff hips? Is it everything above? Or what do you think?
I think you're very astute. It's everything above. And again, we've measured this. I can give several layers of evidence on this, but quite typically, hockey players, every sport adapts the athlete through chronic exposure. Different sports have very specific and different chronic exposures. So when you look right. at a hockey player, they have to pull the leg through. There's a heavy skate on the end of the foot. There's the shin pads. There's a lot of inertia that they've got to pull through. They use heavy hip flexors. So I'm going to stand up for a moment, but just forgive me here. If I keep pulling my hip through with heavy equipment, I develop very strong hip flexors. Now, when we look at an MRI, cross-sectional MRI of an NHL hockey player, they have huge psoas muscles. Now, that adds a stiffness. And when you see a hockey player stand up, it's not always. Obviously, I'm making generalizations. Yeah. But when they pull the hips through, it's hard to pull the hips through because of those big psoas muscles in front.
Yeah.
Now, what's the accommodation? I have to increase my lordosis because of the tight hips to bring ears over my shoulders, over my hips, to stack the mass to stand up tall. So that's one reason. There's other reasons as well. When a player gets a little bit of back pain, and I believe we were the first to measure this, and we wrote a paper, the first author was Stephanie Freeman, Anthony Masha, who is the interventional radiologist, and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And pain tends to corrupt muscle activation and motor patterns. In other words, when you get pain in your hips and your back, the brain reduces the neural drive, the signal to the posterior chain, to the gluteal muscles.
Right.
So, you lose your glutes. It's true. We've measured that. Not in everybody, but in most.
Yeah.
The other thing that it does, so that's called neurogenic, neuro from the pain, reduced gluteal drive. The other is neurogenic facilitation to the psoas muscle. This big, stiff muscle that hockey players develop, and then the brain turns it on even more.
Right. Makes sense.
Yeah, so the great trainers know how to target the psoas. There's a lot more technique to it. When you're targeting a psoas muscle, which there's rectus femoris, which again, a huge muscle because of the adaption in hockey, if you drive your fingers medially into the iliopectineal notch, you can get right on the psoas tendon and do a split lunge. So there's a split lunge. Mm-hmm. Now I would have to put my arm up over my head. And now I feel the psoas really start. And then if you push the heel to the ceiling and spin your hand like this, you will feel the psoas tension change if the person has the heavy facilitation and tight fascia. So now that takes us into a whole nother world.
Right.
So, you know, it's layer upon layer of we are in a linkage that is so connected, and one element of the linkage influences the stress distribution throughout all the rest of it. And, you know, this is why we focus on the training that we do to create exercise that challenges the full linkage in of itself creates a wonderful balance and eliminates the high power production overpowering an underpowered joint, etc. So, you know, I obviously know both of our training, and this is all very much part of the goal. So when you see someone who has the fastest slap shot in the NHL, it won't be the person with the highest squat or the highest bench press. It's the one with the best balance and the nicest fascia and the best storage and recovery of elastic energy, the best timing. Right?
You know? Right. And I think that's like been the fun part for the last like 12 years for me. It's like when I got into like the fascia, and because I was studying in the States, and I in my group was a guy, his name is James Earls. He was working with Tom Myers at the time. And I know Tom Myers and like Tom Myers' work. And so I went dissecting with Tom Myers because I wanted to see this fascia structure inside the body, and it was fresh tissue. So it was, you know, they just died. So it was more like an autopsy. It was very, very, very interesting. So I've done it like 200 plus hours now and like five times because I think it's really interesting. But after that, I changed my view because it's funny you say that the former strong guys, like the former strong, I completely 100% agree with that. It didn't matter if I would have back squatted 260, I wouldn't touch these guys on the ice. But they couldn't touch me in the gym. But I wanted to be good at hockey and movement, but I wasn't because probably too stiff and I couldn't move. But when I was starting to study in this fascia structure, and when you're talking about the collagen around and the vertebrae and the discs and stuff, and we have collagen all over the body, and where we move, we get the collagen stronger. And as you say, we can reproduce elastic energy. And would you say that if we train people with that kind of thought process, so maybe we can take some pressure off the hip joint and maybe the facet joints and the discs, if we get the body to be more working together and be more elastic and be strong as a whole, more farmer strong, so to speak?
Well, yes, but I won't agree with what I was with you until you said hips. So when you look at the hip joint, it's a socket with a ball. It is made to create power. So when you measure the V cuts in the ice, someone who can really accelerate, and they're just a rocket on the ice, they're generating tremendous power in the hips. Yep. Now, when they cut the ice and create that tremendous driving power, if the spine bends, they're pushing rope.
Yeah. Ah. Right.
So we want tremendous power developed in the hips and transferred through a little bit of stone. So you can push stone, but you can't push rope. Yeah. So this is the blended layers that we see in the skeleton. Mobile, tremendously powerful hips pushing a stabilized core into another ball and socket system, the shoulders, they add a little bit more power development, and then it whips through the linkage. So there's a little bit of a boom, an elastic whip through the stiffened core. But, you know, if I was cracking the whip, this is a good example. If I crack the whip with lots of muscle and a big motion, you'll never crack the whip. But if you control the stiffness, proximal stiffness, just a, and then boom, it just works through the linkage. And then you, isn't it fantastic when we watch our players in slow motion? They wind up, you see the elastic storage, and then
it's incredible.
The elastic energy goes into the shaft of the hockey stick, and then it kicks out and releases all that energy with a perfect timing. Or what's always been such a wonderful thing to measure and observe is, you know, these guys, the real ones, the artists, where does that wrist shot come from? They just, then comes out of the core, and the puck just, you know, it is such a nuanced storage and recovery of elastic energy. Or, you know, I think of once or twice I've had my nose in the wrong place and it ended up on a player's elbow in the corner. And all I got was just that stiffened elbow and oh
right. Yep. That hurt. That would hurt.
Oh, I've had a few on the back of my head too, which probably accounts for my memory issues.
Yeah, maybe. That's but no, I agree with you 100%. It's like, yeah, I want the hip to be the power center in the body. And I mean, I think we have the ball and socket joints for a reason, and they're supposed to move and be very freely. And I think what I've seen over the years too, because I haven't used a barbell at all in 15 years. Because as I said, I've been focusing on hockey and alpine skiers, and I don't think they need it. Again, I have nothing against it. If they have great hips, they have great technique, they have great form, I have nothing against it. I have nothing against, there's very few exercises in the world I'm against if they're a great technique. If they're like for the right individual at the right time, and you can, you know, explain why we do this, I have no problem with that. But I think the big problem is today in team sports and what I see in alpine skiing too is the form is so bad, and hockey players and alpine skiers and other athletes they're super strong in their legs, and more than often it's tight hips, and they need to compensate somewhere. And usually the backs do way too much work, and they're not built to handle that kind of a load. And then they are taught to maybe some weird techniques that I know both you and I have little issues with, like the draw in, like you suck in the navel and you hold it there, and I mean, it's just kind of weird. So if you break that down a little bit, would you agree that that's the case? That's, if you take hockey players and skiers now, that really strong legs, very often tight hips, bad technique in lifting. And I mean, alpine skiers, they don't have close to the upper body strength that a hockey player has. So that's even worse when it comes to strong legs and strong hip, but weak core and weak upper body. Could that correlation be?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of issues that you're bringing up.
Yeah.
May I just talk about the alpine skiers and hockey players and heavy squats and whatnot, and then I'll get into the abdominal activation issue.
Love it. Yeah, love that. Yeah.
Okay, consider a downhill skier, and I've worked with several Olympians. I only see people with back issues.
Yeah, I know.
Developed a back issue. And now my job is to reduce the back pain so they can train and win the Olympics.
Yeah.
I always work with the sport coach. I don't get them to the Olympics. I get them out of pain.
Exactly.
And then I give them back to their coach now with these parameters. These are the things we'll have to look after. So let's take a downhill skier. There's no downhill skier on this planet that's going to have a nice lordotic curve, a nice deep squat, and go down the ski hill. They are in a full flexion tuck at well over 100 kilometers an hour, getting pounded on the moguls. It is a very, very tough situation. Now, if I put them into a flexed spine with a barbell on their back to do a few leg squats, you know, with their history of back issues, that's what caused it.
Yep.
They are going to be very disabled athletes. So instead, can I still get that racer's tuck to reduce windage coming down at 120 kilo an hour? Well, yes. And I'm in BackFit Pro right now. I'm just going to turn the camera just a little bit. Do you see that belt squat machine over in the corner there?
Yep.
So now they take all the load through their hips.
Right.
I can put them into a skier's downhill squat. We can simulate the pounding, really build the horsepower that we need, and keep the capacity in the spine.
Yeah.
So that they are still able to train and win. And I will use that with hockey players. Well, it's not a barbell on their back at all.
No.
But that's how, and by the way, even some of the world record squat and powerlifting athletes that I've worked with got into the condition and the strength and power development they needed to win, not by doing heavy barbell work so much, because their capacity would have been used up and they couldn't train to the nth limit. But with that back squat machine, I can take their legs and hips so much further because of the capacity there that isn't in their back. So we're going to use what biology gave us there. So I hope that's a little bit of a comment. And I guess the
overarching
principle there is, I'm going to get flack for this, but I'll say it. Too many strength and conditioning coaches have limited tools. They only know the barbell.
Right.
And I wish they could go to school with you, maybe take some of our courses and learn some of these other techniques that we can really build capacity that biology will allow and support. Anyway, that's the end of my little lecture on that issue. But the one that you brought up was how to coach activating the core, because really you're trying to add stiffness.
Yeah.
And the reason we do that is proximal stiffness in this linkage unleashes distal athleticism. So if I wanted to wiggle my finger very quickly, I had to stiffen my wrist. Otherwise, I wouldn't have the control to do it very quickly.
Yeah.
And the more I move, shoot a puck or whatever, when you measure someone who can rocket the puck, the first thing they build is a core. Now, when you suck in the muscles, can you imagine having a guy wire system on a tower and then you pull the guy wires in tight? You could push it over with some weight. But when you build out the guy wires now and stiffen them symmetrically, that's another key. Symmetric stiffness, you can add compression. You can blow that column over with a hurricane.
Right.
Or you can have someone try and knock you off the puck and they won't do it with farm boy strength.
No.
So this is now a core that's not sucked in, but the entire barrel around the lumbar spine, being rectus, the obliques, transverse, quadratus lumborum, even the psoas muscle about the hip adds to this, excuse me, control and stiffness. So you're not pushing an arm or a shoulder. You're pushing a lump of granite that won't allow, that is now immovable.
Right.
So that's why we would never train, excuse me, the drawing in maneuver, unless they're a bodybuilder, want to have what's called the back look.
Want to blow up the pecs a little bit.
Yeah, but the stiffness that an athlete uses, the cue we might give is to place the fingers lateral and push out laterally. There.
Yeah.
Now, push, shoot, cut into the ice, jump, etc. So there's a little bit of a thought process on that.
Yeah, I love that. And hey, how would you
know who I'm talking to, so I know you
get it. But this is not for us. So we try to help the world do better so we can help our athletes better. But I really appreciate this. So we're talking about, because I mean, I've seen thousands of athletes, and I think the most common denominator is stiff hips. Like, too many people have stiff, because what they do, maybe if you take hockey and skiing here, water sports too, they're using the hips a lot in weird positions in their sport. And then they, especially nowadays, they go home and they sit with their phones. So there's a lot of sitting and there's a lot of weird movements in their sports. So my question really is, when you're using that core work with a very stable hip, how do you see that? You work with the mobility of the hip first before you teach them how to work the core, or how do you see that?
The answer is it depends. Yeah. And we we always get the answer from the assessment.
Yeah.
So sometimes an athlete will have a very wise motor control system, and it just needs a little bit of tweaking or tuning, and maybe it's been corrupted by an injury history or the sport exposure. Funny little story here. We did a study on the police, and when the police officers were walking without any gear on, they walked with their right arm out to the side, and we wondered, why do they have this funny gait pattern? It's because they wear a duty belt when they're on duty with their gun on the right, etc. And so that exposure to their work changed the way they moved 24 hours a day.
Right.
So it was corrupting their patterns. And sport does the same thing, chronic sport exposure as well. And you can work with one sport and all the athletes sit the same way. And you go to another sport and they all sit an entirely different way.
Yeah.
But that then leads me to logically is a great coach. We call it sport and job coaching. We're now coaching 24 hours a day. So they may be practicing an hour and a half on the ice. There's still 22 and a half hours in the day. If they go sit on their phones like a cashew on a floppy couch, I cannot get their back pain better.
Yeah.
It just undoes all of the other goals that we're achieving when we're specifically training. So we get into their lives a little bit. And, you know, we're obviously we're not the only ones that do this.
No.
But a lot of gains are made there as well. So I don't know if that answers your question or not.
I mean, I figure like all like very, very smart people out there usually answers it depends, because it always depends. So I get that. And but yeah, it's yeah. You that listens to this, really listen to what Dr. McGill just said about the sport is a couple of hours a day, and then you have 22 hours more during the day. That is key too. I've seen people with, you know, some injury in the big toe in one foot, and they walk really weird, and they try to do all these things with the hip and the backs and strengthen the core and everything, but they don't care about the big toe is not functioning at all, and they walk in 10, 15,000 steps a day. It'd be really hard to fix anything thinking about the compensation process and everything. So it's, yeah, we need to think about a lot in this and what we do to help people get pain-free.
Yeah, I might say at this point, Andreas, people might find this interesting. I don't do all this on my own. If I need an expert, I will go and get them.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can think of many athletic examples where I've done what I am capable of doing. But then I have to send that athlete to an expert who they might have a little snag in their right quadratus lumborum. I've done everything I can to get rid of their back pain, but we're still left with this little point of pain.
Yeah.
They can put their thumb on it. It's in the muscle. And with two or three soft tissue, real expert that they just know how to release and leave everything else alone, so they don't create a hornet's nest. And then you know, you send to the next massage therapist and they just get a general massage and they stir up a hornet's nest and it's just a mess.
I know,
but right massage person or body worker, whatever you want to call them, they make me look good. So I have my list of experts around the world who are surgeons. For once in a while, surgeons do terrific work on the right thing, and I'll
absolutely
recommend. And I have my people with the magic hands, the body workers.
Yep.
Sometimes it is just the technique of the sport.
Yeah.
You know, you want to run really fast. I know the guy to send you to. Who,
absolutely. Yeah.
If anybody can. You want to shoot a puck harder? I know the person to send you to.
Exactly.
You want to throw a discus further?
Yep.
You want to be a better jiu-jitsu player? I have all of my guys, my colleagues that I rely on in that. So I want to make that clear as well. My little role in this is to give them strategies to deal with it.
Yeah, I agree. And that's a perfect teamwork too. And when we can work together, because I mean, the athlete that flies me all over the world, and that's why I came home today from the States, is because of my hands. And I hope they think this are magic, because they obviously been flying me to back and forth for 14 years to the NHL and to other sports. But and I do a lot of exactly that. It's been a lot of QL work. It's been a lot of QL releases for back pain, and it works, you know. And you're absolutely right. Don't mess up anything else. Just work on where the places where they need to be worked on. And yeah, it's been thousands and thousands of hours. But when you get a hang of it, it's incredible. And which would like put me right into, because I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, because I think it's very interesting to read about, you know, Helen Langevin, her studies about back pain and the viscosity that happens, that it thickens a lot with people with back pain. Have you seen that in your studies, or is her study they're like the first one seeing this, or what do you have to say about that?
Well, Helen and I were both keynote speakers at the 2 years ago World Congress on Fascial.
Yeah, I know.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I spoke to her about her work. She spoke to me a little bit about ours. And when you say back pain, I have to be very careful there because not everyone with back pain has fascial adhesions. Not everyone with back pain has a weak back. In other words, back pain is only a symptom of which there are hundreds of causes and pathways that end up with that symptom of back pain.
Love it.
So, but with Helen's work, there are various myofascial syndromes where the fascia does actually become either the primary generator of pain felt in the back area, or they alter mechanics to
Yes.
create the pain and the symptom in the back.
Right.
Her work measures shear property. So in the palm of your hand, there's no shear. Could you imagine having slippery palms? You
That'd be
couldn't
really weird.
hockey stick or but on my I can move the skin around on my back, but I can't move the skin on the sole of my feet or the palms of my hand. So there are subcategories of back pained people who get adhesions so that there's no shear load. So when I measure them, she does it through very nice ultrasound techniques and medical imaging and whatnot. But when we get them over in the clinic here, we will replicate, say, we'll pull on specific nerve roots. Ah, now my leg has gone numb. And then I will pull the arm up over the head and I'll bend the hand open. Now, you, as a Tom Meyer student, know exactly what I did. I pulled on the fascial train and tensioned it all the way through the chain. Now that caused their back pain. In other words, their tight fascia transmitted a force all the way through several layers of the linkage and now replicated their back pain. So you've just identified a person with what Helen, if you're French, has identified as the primary. So now a good person with good hands. I don't have those hands, so I'm going to refer them now. And if we can allow more shearing, proper shearing of that particular person, the next person has nothing to do with their fascia. So,
No.
but that's the precision of the assessment to know who should get what specific treatment to deal with their specific pathway. But oh, I could talk so much about the fascia and again, that farm boy strength. You know that when we were trained to understand the mechanics of the body, we were taught about muscles being agonists and antagonists. So if I did a bicep curl, the bicep is the agonist, the tricep is the antagonist. What I learned, I used to teach this as I used to teach our first year biomechanics students exactly those principles. When I retired 8 years ago, for about the last 10 years, I couldn't teach it. It was awful. And I had to teach them now that the body is this system. It's called tensegrity, where everything finds its own balance, and that's the shape that you're in. The torso, if say a person has back pain and they've damaged one disc, if I move the spine like this, you can see the majority of the motion is taking place at the disc that has been damaged. This one's normal. This one's normal. Look again. They're not the ones with the huge stress concentrations. Look at the facet joints at the level where that disc has been damaged. If we coach that person and build their core, the barrel around that lumbar spine, you've engineered out that damaged disc. In other words, it's no longer a factor. Every single muscle became the agonist.
Yeah.
Got rid of all of the antagonists.
Yeah.
And it's more curious than that. So with a bicep muscle, it flexes the elbow. It does things at the shoulder, but just grant me this. Cut
Yeah.
me some
Yeah.
slack. Okay, it flexes the elbow.
Yeah.
But now it doesn't do anything in internal, external rotation or twist. Well, it does twist, but now let's take an external oblique. An external oblique causes right twist, right lateral bend, and flexion of the spine. So I can't turn on that muscle 100% because all the muscles on this side are going to have to counteract that.
Yeah.
If I want to stand up, I have to counteract the twist to zero, the flexion to zero, and the lateral bend to zero. In other words, if I do something with right external oblique here, it forced me to do something with all of the family of muscles on the other side. It's a highly constrained, tuned ecosystem.
Yeah.
Every single muscle now is the antagonist. And when we talk about core fitness and core stability and whatnot, what you're doing is tuning this environment of agonists just to hit the stiffness and the elasticity just perfectly, get full power development and transfer from the hips through the core, or vice versa, arresting the movement in the core when the glutes do their thing, the motion is driven to the femur instead of in the spine. And now you measure the guy who accelerates the fastest. And I know you train him. when you watch those accelerating monsters in the NHL, they have fantastically tuned, stiffened cores. Yeah. Otherwise, if the core bends, if they don't get the power to the ice. So you and I have measured these things, and
yeah, a funny story. Funny. It's a true story, and it's not that funny, but it's inspiring because Jesper Bratt, I think you're referring to him. He's one of the fastest guys in the league, and he moves so well. And I trained him from he was 18 and over 6 years, and incredible development. And because I like you explained brilliantly a couple of minutes ago about I'm not interfering with the head coach or whatever, or you know, or the swing coach in golf or whatever it is, or the skiing coach, and I communicate with them. And in hockey they have skill coaches, and I know Jesper's skill coach well here in Stockholm, and so I always talk to them if he sees stuff when he does skill work on ice, and I always ask him, do you see stuff I can work on at the gym for him? And it was a couple of years ago, so I talked to him, and he said, like, yeah, he's getting so powerful now, but his upper body isn't strong enough. So obviously his core was not engaging as fast as he was turning, but he became so powerful. So we needed to work on that. So I listened to the skill coach, took him back to the gym, tested him, and he was correct. He was not recruiting those muscles fast enough, and he was reacting like really fast feet, hips, but not in around the spine. And he had some little bit of back issues he felt now and then, not a lot, but for me, I want them completely pain-free. So for me, it was too much. But when we strengthened him in the right way, he got rid of all the back pain and he got faster than ever. And that has to do with that communication with the skill coach. He recognized in the turns that his upper body couldn't follow the speed he had in the lower legs and the hip, and we fixed that here at the gym. So exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, if you were not you, but if I'm often asked, you know, what causes back pain in athletes, and pan sport, doesn't matter what sport it is, why do they end up coming here? And I would have to say it's an underperforming core. Strength coaches are really good with arms and legs. they're not as good as a group.
No.
And they create these tremendous power developments in the legs and chest and arms and shoulders, but the core is underperforming, and they've got too much horsepower with a sloppy transmission.
I agree 100%. Sometimes you work with a high level athlete and you see him move at the gym, or she, and I'm like, how is this possible? You can barely move, but still very good at their sport. But we can really do make a change, like a big difference for this person or this athlete. And I agree with you.
Well,
so
if you can get a few more years out of their career and they're making $10 million a year in their career, you're very well appreciated.
I mean I think that's what athletes, especially athletes that's making a lot of money. I mean, I know it's a big difference between alpine skiers and hockey players at the highest level, because maybe the top 20 in the world in alpine skiing make okay money, while there's 700 people or 700 players in the NHL. And I mean, there's a lot of hockey players that are doing okay. But I think, as you said, they recognize that if they invest, let's say in you or me, let's say they invest, let's say $1 million. Let's take a high number. They invest $1 million in you and me or whatever to get help, to get, like, they can perform better. But maybe if they extend the career 2 years or 1 year, one season, and they make, as you said, maybe $10 million that year, or $5 million, or $4 million that year.
How about $45 million?
I mean, no hockey player makes that money, but yeah, in 1 year, but yeah. But you get it, right? So they would, I mean, the return of investment is incredible. Not only will you perform better during when you're playing at the time, but you can also extend your career by investing in yourself, by getting the best help. And I think, and be humble enough, as you said too, use other experts too. Don't think you know it all yourself. Like, use, because I've been using you for my athletes. Because I'm pretty good with back pain, absolutely, because that was my first passion, because I had to quit hockey because of back pain. So that's why I've been a big back pain guy in Sweden. But I still think you are smarter than me, so I want to hang out with you, because you have more knowledge and more experience, because you're a couple of years older than me and been focusing only on back pain, and I've been focusing more on performance. So why wouldn't I use you, who's the best, what I think, in the world in the back pain, for my athletes? That would be stupid not to do. But if I thought
that's,
I knew
why
it all,
I send them back to you.
Love it. That's teamwork, man.
Yep.
So I want to talk about a couple of other things before we're going to wrap this up. But why do you think it's, because we said before, we kind of a little bit hard on the barbell, because we think sometimes it does more harm than good. Why do you think that's for so many trainers, it's just religion? And if we mention the barbell in a negative way, they freak out and get so pissed off and so angry. Well, we just care about the athlete. We want the best for the athlete. We don't care about the barbell itself. We want the best exercise for the right person at the right moment to enhance their performance so they can get better at their sport. I remember when Mike Boyle, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when Mike Boyle, he I think he wrote an article called, like, Death to Squats or something like that, because he stopped doing back squats, period, with all his, like, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of athletes at his performance centers. And he reduces back pain by 95%. And then he wrote this article, and people were just ripping him apart because he said something bad about squats. And I mean, why do you think that is? That's, this barbell is such a religion piece of thing.
Well, if anyone's been to Mike Boyle's training center and have worked with him and his staff, he produces results.
Yep.
No one can argue with the number of players he has in pro baseball, the NFL, and the NHL.
Yep.
So, why is this? I don't know. Now, I can also tell you that Mike Boyle uses the barbell. So, sometimes there's a little bit of a misinterpretation, I think, in all of this. I remember I said something at a Perform Better meeting about doing split squats versus, two-legged symmetric squats and whatnot. And people started to get all in a huff. And they said, well, this doesn't reconcile with Mike Boyle. And, you know, there aren't very many coaches who I would say I dislike. We may have different opinions, but we're all friends and colleagues. And anyway, so Mike and I wrote a position statement for the NSCA on this, actually. And it was just to show it was a great misunderstanding, because how can you talk about squats and split squats and Romanian, you know, whatever, without talking about volume?
Right.
Rep,
yes.
All of the other variables, because it has to have context.
Yes.
So once we got into the context of the article, everybody said, oh, okay. they got all in a fluff. So I think, you know, we all use barbells. We wouldn't have the record performances in Olympic lifting, powerlifting, and in the NHL without barbells. But this is highly nuanced. And when someone has a compressive load intolerance, you cannot put a lot of weight down the back and expect to have a restoration of playing capacity. It just isn't going to work. So now, well, let me put it this way. And again, this will cause a little bit of an issue, I think. Any trainer can train an 18-year-old, make a few mistakes, get some good gains, because an 18-year-old is resilient.
Right.
But if you do that with a 28-year-old NHL veteran who has a history now, good miles on their body, they are nowhere close to their peak strength. They're still killing it in the NHL. They had their biggest strengths when they were 18 or 19 in college or in the, you know, the junior league.
Yeah.
And they now play in the NHL based on experience, technique, guile, all of these things that they know work for them. They know they can't overtrain. They know they have to, you know, they know what they need to do. And people will be surprised how many big football players in the NFL really don't do much loaded barbell work down their back.
No.
They can't make it anymore. Those days are gone. Their prime was when they were in college. And when you nuance it like this, they may get in a fluff and I'll say, okay, well, how many active NFL football players do you have at the moment? You know what the answer is.
Mm-hmm.
And, but that's what they do. It's the tools they know. But if they went and worked with you or worked with Mike Boyle, or they came over here or worked with Dan Paff in sprinting in Arizona, or they worked in, you know, I could name, you know, in the UFC, go train with John Chainberg up in Montreal, who's worked with many, many marquee UFC athletes.
Yeah.
It's not what the average trainer would think. So maybe that's a little bit of a essay around that that whole issue.
No, I get it. Because I don't think it is an issue. I mean, we want the best for our athlete, and we use the tool that we're, you know, comfortable with, and but especially what makes results. And Mike Ball definitely have results, absolutely, like you and I too. And yeah, I know he uses barbell to a lot of stuff, but I think he stopped doing like heavy, and too much load to the wrong athlete at the wrong time. And that's, no one should do that.
Yeah. But I mean, what is tragic, and I know you see this, and I certainly do, where really good athletes are screwed up with somehow they got buying into, in order to play in the NHL, you have to heavy squat X to a certain depth as well.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that they might have ongoing hip pathology or FAI, or which isn't uncommon in hockey players as well.
Yeah.
So, you know.
They did there was a study a few years ago where they looked at the hips in like 700 whatever plus players. I think it was college players. And I think from 12 years to 19 years old. I don't know if you've seen this study. But I think like already at 12 years old, they could see some differences in the hip joint. And at 19, I think it was like 93% that had some issues going on. But that didn't mean they had pain. but it was something going on. Even it was labrum or whatever it was, but it was something. It was not great hips at 19 already for too much skating. So we can kind of figure out that maybe skating is not the best movement for hips at that volume that most player does, right?
Well, in my line of work, I see formerly great athletes, and they're now civilians, 50, 60, and 70-year-olds. Some of them have made many, many, many millions of dollars. And some of them come to me and say, if I'd known it was going to hurt this bad, I never would have done it.
Right.
And these are marquee superstar people. So this myth that athletes are healthy for life is exactly that. It's a myth.
Yeah.
And if you want a good, modest, pain-free life, I wouldn't recommend being a pro athlete of anything.
No.
And if you're good at something in the world, you are hard on your body. And
oh, yeah. I mean, I say that all the time in the lectures and stuff too. Like elite sports is not healthy at all. It's no. Really, really tough.
Yeah.
And it will be
funny when I'll work with some of the Masters Olympians, and you know, if you look at who's the gold medalist in shot put for over 80 years old. Now I can characterize that person for you. Do you think they're a former Olympian? No, because every former Olympic shot putter, not every, but the vast majority of them will not be able to throw a shot put when they're 80. They're worn out.
Yeah.
That 80-year-old who just won the Masters Olympics was a couch potato until they were 55. They rested and prepared their body. Now they can start training again slowly and gain some athleticism. It just happens to be more than what's left of the former athletes. So, you know, it's really fun to look at some of the Masters athletes, and
that's incredible.
They rested their bodies for years.
So another question I have is, so obviously the spine, 13, 14 year old, like pre-puberty, and the spine at a 25 year old is going to be different, and different material and different stiffness. So I know there's a lot of problem with, especially skiers, that young skiers are really, really good at skiing, and their angles and the force production they make while skiing is unbelievable at the really young age. And because they ski so much, they're really, really good. They want to ski more. So they can ski, maybe some of them skis 300 days a year, a lot of hours. And they end up with like severe back problems. Do you have any experience, any thoughts about that? What can happen to the spine if you put that kind of compression and volume at that young age at the spine?
Well, I'll tell this little story because it's not an uncommon one. Mom or dad will bring a junior athlete here. Say this kid is 14 or 15 years old, and I will ask the kid, not the parent, I want to hear from the kid, the player, tell me about your training. And they'll say something and they don't get what I'm asking. I say, well, what did you do on Monday? And they'll say, well, I went to the ski slopes and I skied for 2 hours. And then I went to my strength coach and we did even more heavy squats. And I said, okay, what's your volume and whatnot? And then I said, okay, what'd you do on Tuesday? Oh, I hit the slopes and then I had my session with the sports psychologist. And then I had my session with, you know, the running coach or whatever it happened to be. And okay, what'd you do on Wednesday? Oh, well, then we got back and I did heavy squats and deads and, you know, whatever it happened to be. And I'm mapping all of this out. And then I finally get through to Sunday and I say, when was your last day off? And the kid says,
what?
Well, what? I said, when was your last day off? And they can't answer that. And then I look and turn at the parent and say, I don't know of a single professional athlete in this sport who trains at this volume of exposure.
No.
And the parent never understood that they're so keen to support their kid. And I get it. Who makes the NHL? It's
right.
the kid who has parents that will take them to the sports psychologist and the strength coach and
yep.
to Andreas. And, you know, I get
yep.
that. I'm the same.
Yep.
But someone has to be steering the ship a
yep.
little bit and
right.
coordinating all of this. And I end up quite often being that person to organize an exposure with good rest periods so that we can bring this young body along and not break it.
What would you say with the resting periods would be for like pre-puberty or like right in the start beginning of puberty? Because you said like one day a week for the weightlifters, they lift one day and then they rest for a week or recover and build up to collagen.
If they're pre-puberty, I wouldn't do weight training.
No.
Nope, not at all. I would do all body weight.
Yeah.
I would do push-ups, chin-ups.
Absolutely, yeah. But and we talk about skiing. For skiing, that's a lot of compression too. So, well, how much would you ski? You think, like, I mean, it's a really hard question to ask.
Well, again, it's a really hard question, and you know, as I said, you can't train a Saint Bernard to run at the Greyhound track. So let's see, is this kid a Greyhound or a Saint Bernard? If they have the physical constitution to withstand a higher volume, they might thrive on that. Now that
yeah.
volume is not, it's high, but it's not unlimited.
Right.
The next one, just they are not there yet. They are, have a small frame. There's no way they can carry that volume of training.
Right.
I don't know if I'm really answering your question, except the answer is A, it depends.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of science and a little bit of horse sense. That's the art of being a great trainer,
yeah.
to know when more rest is required. But I think there's a little bit of a scientific approach for this. I wish more athletes and trainers would train in cycles. And what I mean by that is, okay, let's do a cycle of 2 weeks. What are the goals? Let's organize. So if they're out of season and you want to get a bit of a strength base, okay, for the next 2 weeks, we're going to add to the strength base. You will not do speed. You're not going to do this. We're going to do a lot of rest. You know what I mean, et cetera. And then, so there's 2 weeks. In the first week, one day is completely off. The second week, you get 3 or 4 days off at the end of that cycle. Okay, now let's do another training cycle. Let's do a bit more strength. Okay, and then finally, we're going to start to, this cycle now, we're focusing on a little bit more speed off the mark, a little bit more explosiveness. You got your strength base. We're going to back off on the strength and let's go to the next cycle and goal. So, you know, again, I end up organizing these things because the parent just thought more of everything and piling it on is going to produce a better athlete, not realizing that they're going to end up with a broken athlete.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a scientific way, I suppose, of creating an exposure that makes good sense from an athletic development point of view in a kid.
I agree. And I think that's a big, big issue with a lot of young athletes is that the volume is, it's way, way, way out there. It's way too much. Oh. It's people, when people come to me and see how much we train, how much I train the pros during the summer, they're like, is that it? I'm like, yeah. So we train Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday is so relaxing recovery day. We take care of tissues, take care of the body. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, Sundays is off. So we train four and a half days a week. But we train, we train. But I've experimented so much with two sessions a day, one session a day, and blah, blah, blah in like 20 years. And when I decreased the load a lot, the results exploded. It was just another thing. And yeah, it's going to depend and depends on athlete, depends on age and stuff like that too. Absolutely. But it's, I promise you what I've seen in my experience, it's usually less. Like I sometimes say, how little can we train for optimal results?
Right. You know, another thing was coming into my mind as you were describing this, and I know you do it. We certainly emphasize it as well. While we will train rate of muscle onset and rate of muscle relaxation. That's the pulse. That's what gives you the speed, the ability to turn and all of that. More heavy deads, more heavy squats. You know, I've done this with a couple of sports organizations. You can't do it if you're doing heavy strength. That could be one cycle, but now you got to back right out of that and to train the pulse.
Yeah.
And I was really educated that years ago, working with sprinters. So, you know, it's the strength, then it's a bit of neurology, and it is that huge pulse and relaxation that gives the speed.
And that's the tough part I've seen, the relaxation. I mean, to put it on, they can do, most athletes, but most to relax fast, that's the difference, right?
Exactly. And that's what gives the slap shot and everything else. So, now, if you take all these coaches who are going to get upset with you, who say, well, you're taking the barbell out of squats, you'll say, okay, well, when do you train rate of muscle relaxation? Because that will determine how fast they throw the ball, how hard they punch and kick, you know, how hard they get off a mogul, et cetera.
And movement efficiency.
There's usually dead silence at that point. But this is social media. You don't get the nuance and the context, and everybody's an expert, I know.
I mean, as I said in the beginning, we're just here to help. We want to do it our best. And I think we can easily course correct too. And if you can prove me better, I will change. I have no problem with that. I was like, I was completely against for a while too, to do just core stability, because they, when I hurt my back and had to quit hockey, they told me I was weak in my core. Because, and I'm like, I'm not weak. I can back squat 220. Why do you say I'm weak? I'd be a lot of things, but I'm not weak, you know? And to have me on the floor, look at the blood pressure cuff, how much I can squeeze a muscle, doesn't make sense to me. See, I was really angry with that for a long while, until I really understood it, because the person who did it to me, they didn't understand this. And it was you that explained this to me through your books, that it was not about that. It was not about what they were talking about. I was not weak. It had nothing to do with that. It's like what you're talking about right now. That's, I couldn't fire, and my stiff hips didn't do the work. So, and I was overloading with massive volume playing hockey in like different teams. I was playing with adults when I was 16. And add to that, training harder than most. And so I probably did like two strength sessions with heavy squats and deads and bench and all that a day. You know, it could be like four or five strength sessions a week, plus maybe, I don't know, 8 to 10 hockey sessions. And then I lived out of, you know, really bad food. And you wonder why my body completely broke down. That's my story. So final question, Dr. Stuart McKill, again, thank you so much for taking your time. I really appreciate this. I love this talk. And I have a I like golf. I don't play golf myself because I don't have time during the summer, and when I do things, I really want to be good at it, to enjoy it. And as long as I'm training a lot of athletes during the summer, I don't have the time, but I know I will start playing golf because I love to watch it. And I'm helping a few golfers too, because I love the sport so much. And I'm getting more and more interested in golf because I just enjoy watching it so much. But it's a couple of thoughts about golfers and the swing in golf, because that's they kind of create a scoliosis while swinging. It's just a weird position and a weird movement for the spine, I guess. So what would you, any thoughts on golf and the swing?
I have a lot.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about you, I would need to assess you to give you my best advice. But I can give some generic principles. If
Please.
You want to play golf, I wouldn't get very strong.
No.
I would work on mobility and strategic elastic mobility as well. And then I'd say to you, well, swing a club and show me where we are. And then I would tell right away, whether you turn your hips, so that would we was what we would call a turner, or do you lock your hips and spin your spine? That's called a twister. So depending on whether you're a turner or a twister or somewhere in between, I'm starting to formulate now. I want to see how you externally rotate the trailing leg to get the turn or the twist. I want to see the pulse just before ball impact, and that will tell me a lot about are you storing and recovering elastic energy efficiently, or are you using too much muscle? Because the ones who hit the longest ball aren't the ones with the most massive muscle contractions, because if you've ever tried to hit a golf ball hard, you use too much muscle, you slow down, and the ball doesn't go very far. So there's a lot of moving parts there. Then I would send you to, if I uncovered a flaw in your linkage that hadn't manifested into pain yet. So like you in hockey, I have several in many different sports, but in golf, I might send you to a guy named perhaps Ben Shear, Ben Shear Golf. Ben and I have shared many top PGA golfers. My job is to get them out of pain. Ben's job is to get them back on the tour. And it's a really nice combination, but let's invest in your golf. And Ben will patiently develop the athleticisms once the pains are dealt with. Because if you have pain, you're snookered. You're not going to be able to train well anyway. Or if it was more of a specific soft tissue or a joint, I might send you to someone like Clayton Skaggs, who runs the Central Institute for Human Performance in St. Louis in Missouri. Anyway, that's sort of the answer, and it's the only truth I can give you. My assessment would guide me on this.
Yeah, I agree completely. It's just watch hockey player play golf, the ones who uses the muscles. It's pretty fun to watch.
Yeah, but there's some awfully good golfers who play hockey.
100%. They're really, really good, but they're not very efficient. So wait till they get efficient, because they're so good without being a golfer level efficient, if you know what I'm
Yeah,
talking
well,
about.
you'd be surprised at the number of NHL players who, once they retire, they do focus on golf.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
There's one on our website who, I think for assists, he's in the top 10 of NHL history. I
Oh,
mean,
wow.
now he's just a passionate golfer and really good at it.
Yeah. The
He's
hockey
just.
players are incredible golfers, no doubt about it. But I've seen
Yeah.
a lot of hockey players with, their tight hips and just using the back when they swing. They're
Yeah.
still good because they're so used to a stick in a puck or a ball, whatever. But their technique is will probably end up with a little bit of back pain after a while if they're not start using
Well,
their at this
they
thing.
have to they all come with miles on their body, but
Absolutely.
yeah.
So before we wrap up a little bit, here's to the Swedish people listening to this. I'm going to hold this in I don't know if it's the right way here, but if it's mirrored, I don't know. But on if you're watching this on YouTube, so this is actually a book from Dr. McGill in Swedish. So this has been translated.
Yeah, in Stockholm.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So it's I have the because I love to read in English to keep my English updated, but so here's the English and I got the Swedish.
Right.
So it's I'm going to say this in Swedish. It's called Bli din egen ryggmekaniker. So I really recommend because you would say this book is for more for laymen, right?
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's for the lay public to guide them out of their specific
Yeah,
back
it
pain.
should be that would be a great book for athletes, right?
It's where they should start to get out of pain. And then once they've achieved that, the world opens up. Now they have to get training for the sport. And that's the
Yeah.
next book. It's called Ultimate Back Fitness and Performance.
Yeah. And you want to mention the other two?
Well, I have for the strength athletes now, Gift of Injury. And it's the story of a fellow named Brian Carroll, who came to me with a fairly heavy spine injury. And we got him out of pain, which was my objective. And then he said, I want my world record back because he held the world record in squats. And I said, well, all right, I'll tell you what I know. However, if you get your world record back, we can write a book about that because that's a hell of a story. He set the world record, and now he still owns the world record of squats of 1,306 pounds. So that's over 600 kilo.
At what
And
age?
he's now 42, but he would
Oh,
have
wow.
set that record when he was around 38, I think.
That's incredible.
Yeah, he had a bicep torn off. He was in COVID. And he squatted 1,306. That's the
Wow.
all-time human record. Doesn't matter about weight class category or anything. That's the most.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
So,
Well, and that book,
we do like barbells.
of course we do.
Yeah.
We like everything that's adjusted to that specific athlete. I mean,
That's right.
right? That
Yeah.
guy would not squat 1,300 pounds if he's not using the barbell. That would not happen. You know, it's
No.
so he's just again, we have nothing against any exercise. It's just
Right.
look at the volume, look at the form, work on the technique. And I mean, what kind of sport do you do? How strong do you really need to be? Like you said with the golfer, how strong do you really need to be? Same with the hockey player. Look at McDavid. Do you think McDavid is the best, strongest guy in the weight room? I doubt it.
No.
But he's by far the best player in the world. No, I mean, maybe the MacKinnon too, but I mean, there are some incredible athletes out there. There are maybe not the biggest guys in the weight room or lifting the biggest weights. So again, like movement efficiency, there's so many things to look for to build a super athlete.
Agreed.
Agreed. So Stuart, thank you so much. Where else can we people find you if you want people to find you?
Well, yeah, I'm retired now. I'm
Yeah,
not a
I
great
know.
guy in social media. We still see patients one day a week, but we have a whole network of trained clinicians on our website, backfitpro.com. If people want resources, the best thing to do is just to go to the website
Yep.
and, maybe just put that in your show notes if anyone
Absolutely. Yeah, we
how to
put
spell
everything
it.
in the show notes. Yeah, we put
But other
everything in
than
the show notes.
that, yeah, I just want to say thank you for all you do, and let's keep getting players into the NHL and onto the ski slopes. So thanks for all you do.
Thank you. I appreciate your words, and I hope we can do this again someday. This was fun. Like I
Yeah.
really enjoyed speaking to you.
Yeah, likewise. Okay, Andreas, so
All
long.
right. I'm gonna hit goodbye.